Todd Murphy, our special guest tonight here on Coast to Coast. But I was looking at his website. Is it cool? He's got all kinds of things up there, so you might want to take a look at it. It's linked up with his name at coasttocoastam.com. When we come back, we are going to talk about the brain and its ability to deal with the spiritual and paranormal aspects of life. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. Todd Murphy, a member of the Laurentian University Behavioral Neurosciences Research Group. He's a four-time author for the Journal of Near-Death Studies, including groundbreaking theories on Darwinian reincarnation, and his interest is in the preservation of religious and spiritual practices in these times of changing religious beliefs. His education includes several spiritual teachers, including the gurus from India, spiritual healers, as well as from the Native American traditions. Todd has also developed several neurotechnologies and guided meditations based on principles of neuroscience, as well as new methods of spiritual coaching. He's our guest tonight on Coast to Coast. Todd, this is great to have you on the program. How are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing fine. You know, I had a great day looking at your website today, and some of the apparatuses that you have on the heads of people. Tell me about that. What are those tests that are conducted on people? What are they?
Well, it's a mind machine, which can be purchased like any other mind machine. The testing phase actually ended a few years ago. The very first generation of Shakti was a helmet, which is now discontinued. And the first phase was a safety test where people used it primarily looking for ill effects. We didn't find very much. Then we moved to the next phase, which is where we were starting to look at how effective it was and ways to make it more effective. Soon after that, I developed another brain stimulation device, which actually uses coils, magnetic coils that can be moved and placed on different areas of the brain. The way it works is we start off with EEG traces, little squiggly lines that correspond to brain waves.
Right.
And these were derived from deep in the brain using depth electrodes. And these are actually electrodes that are put in the heads of patients, primarily to screen them for surgery for what's called intractable epilepsy. And by putting these electrodes deep in the brain, they're able to figure out where the epileptic seizure is beginning, so they know where to cut, and hopefully they don't have to cut out any more than they absolutely need to.
And this is pretty accurate?
Yes. Well, a lot depends on what you mean by accurate. But a brainwave signal of this type derived from one person will always appear with everybody else. So one of the signals is a burst firing pattern derived from a structure called the amygdala. Another is a long-term potentiating pattern derived from a structure called the hippocampus. And I'll be discussing those two structures more as we go along, I think. But the basic idea is that you play the signals out through a computer sound card or early on through a CD. And now you're outputting an EEG signal, you're outputting a brain wave, and the specific structure that that signal comes from will be selectively activated by the magnetic analog, the magnetic counterpart to it. The amygdala recognizes its own signal. The hippocampus recognizes its own signal. I'm oversimplifying a bit because these structures work with many different
signals. No, absolutely.
But a good metaphor is imagine that you're in a room with 200 people carrying on 100 conversations in 100 languages. You stand on a table and you shout something in Serbo-Croatian. Only two of the people will really respond to it. Similarly, you can put a signal into the brain, a magnetic signal, and the structure that it's derived from will respond far more than any other structure will. And in this way, we're able to activate specific structures deep in the brain in their association with, in their connection to, the frontal lobes, the temporal lobes, the parietal lobes, and so forth. And this gives us a wide range of effects. And there's been quite a lot of research over the last, depends on who you're talking to, how far it goes, but the real stuff has been happening since the early 90s, that allow us to see which parts of the brain are most implicated in different types of religious and mystic experiences. Now, paranormal and psychic perception is another category of brain activity. But For example, the amygdala is a very emotional structure.
Sure.
On the right side, it's specialized for fear. It can produce anxiety in many kinds of psychiatric disorders.
It sometimes kicks in that reptilian part of your brain, too, doesn't it?
Well, that's another subject. Actually, I think I can remember that. I think I can pick up the train of thought where I left it off, so I'll just go there for a brief second. The idea of a reptilian brain originates with a neuroscientist named Paul MacLean, who developed what's called the triune brain theory, the three-level brain theory. And we have a mammalian brain, a human brain, a mammalian brain, and a reptilian brain under that. Now, the amygdala is part of what's called the reptilian brain, but we don't have a reptilian amygdala. Now, a cat... The amygdala of a cat has 7 nuclei. The amygdala of a chimpanzee has 12. The amygdala of a human being has 20. So the reptilian brain in human beings is a human limbic system.
Right.
It's
right.
Not a reptilian brain with mammalian stuff grown over it and then human stuff grown over that. Our brain is human, top to bottom, stem to stern. And there is probably no part of the brain that was unaffected by our transition to Homo sapiens. So we have a human brain.
Some of us do.
At least we hope so.
Yeah.
In my neighborhood, it's open to question. But getting back to the amygdala, the right, as I just said, is specialized for fear, anxiety, and emotions like that. And the one on the left is specialized for, well, let's call it positive affect. In fact, the English language is very good at describing negative emotions, and not quite so good at describing positive ones. So if you stimulate the amygdala on the left with magnetic signals, and you don't already have an active left amygdala, if it's a little bit quieter than it normally would be, when it comes into activity in response to the stimulation, you're going to experience positive emotions. Now, this can range anywhere from a feeling of well-being to elation to outright bliss, the sort that cannot be described in words and evokes the numinous and an otherworldly positive feeling.
Can you overstimulate the amygdala?
Can you overstimulate it? Yes, it is quite possible to do so. And in fact, the software that drives these brain stimulation devices, which are called Shakti, actually has limitations on the session length. The longest the software will allow you to stimulate, to run any stimulation, is 1 hour. So we don't get, I don't think we get close to the point where the amygdala on the right, and I do want to go on the left, and I do want to go over this a little bit because it's a theme that I hope to return to. It can actually become so active that activity from the amygdala on the left can spill over directly into the amygdala on the right. And there's a little structure dedicated only to communication between these two called the anterior commissure. Now, if you build it up on the left enough and you get blissful enough, it can actually spill over into the amygdala on the right and it can turn into fear. So, for example, in ordinary life, this kind of thing acts as a sort of safety valve to make sure that our emotions don't carry us away to the point where we start acting, I'll use the scientist's term, maladaptively. We don't start doing the wrong thing or the stupid thing. So, for example, you go out on a date with a woman. It's a first date. It's absolutely magnificent. She gives you that sensual peck on the cheek, and you know that she felt the same way about it. And then you go in and you sit down and you say, well, now, wait a minute. Is she really the right one? Is she going to dump me? Am I going to feel different tomorrow?
Well, the first thing you'd say is, that's it? The sensual peck on the cheek?
Well, for a first date. There could be feminist listeners, you know.
That could be.
Yes, and some conservative religious believers with their traditional morality. But the point is, when an experience becomes too good for us to handle, we can actually dump some of the activation into another brain structure and sort of mute it or dampen it a bit. When I first heard that I was going to be on this program, which I was first suggested, someone first suggested that I try and get on your program back in 97, I was absolutely elated. Wow, how many people will listen to me? I will be heard. People will visit my website. I shall become a feature on the landscape. What a good boy am I. And then I start thinking, well, now, wait a minute. What if I start coughing a lot? You know, what if I stumble over my words? Uh-huh. I should be careful. What if trolls call in and want to give me a hard time? And then as I actually prepared myself for the program, I was able to get my hands onto the meat of the matter, the nuts and bolts of explaining what I do, and not be so carried away by elation that I took my own ability to do the job for granted and was, I think, better able to prepare for this.
You just be yourself, Todd. That's it.
Right. But myself is composed of a being, is myself includes someone who can feel elation and joy and bliss, and also someone who can cautiously monitor himself so that I do a good job and explain things well for real.
Well, that's what most of us should be doing, shouldn't we?
We should be doing it. But when you start talking about extremely high levels of activation, this kind of process can actually unfold into religious and mystic experiences.
Now, without the brain, would these experiences still occur? Would we still have the spiritual, the paranormal, maybe the near death, without the brain existing?
Well, one answer is, if the brain didn't exist, I wouldn't be able to answer the question. Another is, I've never worked with anyone without a brain, so I have no personal experience to go on. And the third answer is that there is a class of person, a very rare type. They're called anencephaletics. And these are people who have, for all intents and purposes, no brains. Their skulls are filled with cerebrospinal fluid, and yet somehow they are able to function and in some cases do extremely well in life. I don't know much about them. And people who want to learn more shouldn't ask me. They should Google anencephaletic and see what they come up with. Such people do exist.
That's amazing.
And when you take this very rare and understudied group and wonder about them, if they're capable of religious and mystic experiences, I think there's very, very little data to go on.
Well, I guess if one dies, and when one dies, of course, the brain is supposed to, you know, cease functioning. It decays and it becomes nothing. What about these spiritual experiences that people are having, the ability to see the other side, to believe in ghosts and, you know, a soul? And I'm at wit's end in terms of, okay, so we don't have the brain anymore, yet so many people testify to the existence of this other side. Is it really there, in your opinion?
Well, I assume you're talking about out-of-body experiences and near-death experiences.
And exactly, and the whole works of believing in that other dimension that might be there.
I have no trouble believing in what near-death experiencers call the veridicality of out-of-body experiences, because I've been out of my body. When I was a child, I had temporal lobe epilepsy, and the locus of my seizures, the place where the seizures began, was almost certainly in the hippocampus on the right side. And every time I had a seizure, I had a near-death experience. I went out of my body many, many times. During the seizures, I had a set of phenomena that recurred each time. The most compelling of them had two aspects to it, one with my eyes open and the other with my eyes closed. And with my eyes open, what I would experience was myself in an enormous amphitheater-sized bedroom. My room seemed to literally expand to unbelievable size. So that, for example, as I sit here at my desk looking at my phone, let's say, is 2 feet from me and 10 inches from top to bottom. In this experience, it would look like it was 200 feet from me and 1,000 inches from end to end, so that it still subtended the same angle. It still took up as much of the visual field as it did before, but it seemed as if everything had been expanded to an enormous size. When my eyes were closed, I had an experience of looking into what I've now learned has termed the void, so that I would feel myself not in an enormous space, but in infinite space. And this space had a vibrant, emphatic quality about it. It seemed to have a texture, even though I wasn't touching it in any way. And right in the center of my visual field, an unimaginable distance from me, was a point of light that was infinitely brilliant. And I experienced many other strange phenomena. Out-of-body experiences actually didn't occur during my seizures. They actually would happen several hours before I went to bed. And they would sort of presage the onset of a seizure. Now, at this point, I do want to say this was pediatric temporal lobe epilepsy. I had it from the age of 7 to about the age of 9. And almost all pediatric temporal lobe epilepsy stops with the onset of puberty as the brain rewires itself for the new tasks and pleasures of adulthood.
Well, it is. It's a remarkable machine.
Yes, indeed. So how is it possible that I could be out of my body and at the same time continue to work with my brain? And I believe in the veridicality of out-of-body experiences not only because I've experienced them. A personal experience is not a guide to truth. Rather, there have been a couple of cases that have been published in the Journal for Near-Death Studies in which patients who had out-of-body experiences as part of near-death experiences and doctors around to verify that they were in fact clinically dead. And in these cases, they went out of their body and saw, in one instance, a red tennis shoe on the roof of the hospital. And when the patient came out, an old woman who had a cardiac arrest, she was desperate to know if there was a red tennis shoe on the roof of the hospital. Because if that tennis shoe was there, then it did not all end when her body ended.
That's right.
So she really, really wanted to know. Now, this happened to have happened at a hospital in Hartford, where there were a couple of near-death researchers on staff, and there was some talk about the throughout the hospital. People knew about this line of research, whatever they thought of it. So when someone came, hey, we need a janitor to unlock the roof so we can go up there to find out if this really happened, they got a janitor, they got a nurse to, you know, be the witness, and they went up and got the red tennis shoe and handed it to the patient. And I have heard, not in the published literature, but I've heard that the woman took the red tennis shoe, clutched it to her breast, and just had this beatific smile come over her. Because that, this beaten-up, weather-worn shoe, was proof that life did not end with death.
Now, to you, is that a science or is it supernatural?
Well, in my line of work, the distinction between the two is somewhat blurred. But I want to get back to your original question. How can the brain continue to guide and shape these experiences when we are out of our bodies and we are out of our brains?
Yes.
And the answer is a little bit complicated. In 1992, it was discovered at UCLA, the researcher's name was Joseph Kirschwink, that our brains actually have 5 million magnetite crystals per gram, and the average human brain's got about 1,400 grams. That's a lot of magnetite crystals. And no one knows exactly what their real function is. We're still at the stage where people are offering speculation and hypothesis. My own notion is that what's happening is that there is an entire level of neural activity where magnetic signals are transferred between these crystals so that whatever's happening on a neurochemical level, on a neuroelectrical level, is also happening with this magnetic system in the brain.
Almost wireless, Todd?
Almost wireless, and I'll get to that point with the next comment. What I think is happening is that when we're out of our bodies, the magnetic signals which were in our brains leave our bodies and exist in the medium of the Earth's magnetic field. And there is an entity in physics that covers the ground. It would be called a soliton,
Hold that thought right there, Todd. We're going to take this quick break. We'll be right back when we talk about these magnetic signals. You're onto something. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be back with Todd Murphy in just a moment. I want to tell you about the closing moments of giving away the two CDs. We've got about a month left, and we're going to stop this program. So take advantage of it. The two great shows, the renewals, you'll get them as well. The Malachi Martin programs on demons and perfect possession and exorcisms. These are classic old Art Bell programs that we scurried and found them. They were hidden away in a mountainside in Pahrump, Nevada, and we took them and brought them back. But they're great programs. And if you want to subscribe to the After Dark newsletter, you get the programs for free by calling 1-888-727-5505. That's 1-888-727-5505. Or you can go online, and that's very safe and secure, coasttocoastam.com. And we're back with behavioral scientist, neuroscientist Todd Murphy. Todd, you were picking up about magnetic signals, and we got the clock got us there.
That's all right. Let's see. The idea is that when we leave our bodies, the magnetic components embodied in a very dense distribution of magnetic crystals in our brains, that retains its coherency when we're out of our bodies, so that what we experience subjectively as reality supported by our brain's activity can continue on. And there is an entity that physics knows about that can cover this ground. It's called a soliton. And a soliton is a standing wave. If you imagined a wave in a stream that stood still and didn't flow with the stream, mm-hmm. you'd have an idea what we're talking about. And such things have been observed. And if you have a soliton that contains information the way a hologram does, with two sources and interference patterns that actually hold the information, then you have the capacity for subjective experience outside of our bodies and existing in the medium of the Earth's magnetic fields. Now, another way to take the same to approach the same question is simply to look at out-of-body experiences as they're commonly reported. And people have out-of-body arms and legs. They call it a subtle body or an energy body or an etheric body or what have you. Why not an out-of-body brain?
That's not a bad idea.
So if our brains continue to exist or our capacity for subjective experience continues to exist, then you have out-of-body experiences in which people can experience all sorts of things, including the full range of human emotions, without the need for a physical brain.
I was going to say, which could explain why so many people have these abilities outside of the body.
Yes. People do certainly experience unusual things when they're outside of their bodies. I haven't studied spontaneous out-of-body experiences anywhere near as I've looked into near-death experience, out-of-body experience.
Are you convinced that these near-death experiences would prove, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that something exists after death?
Well, beyond the shadow of a doubt is a tall order.
I know.
But I believe they certainly evidence it. I accept it myself. Yeah, I guess that's the answer to your question.
Do you accept it yourself because of your own experiences that you've talked about, or because of a belief system?
Well, because of a belief system, but my belief system is largely derived from the knowledge that has been learned by near-death studies and near-death research.
You know, I have always, Todd, been so perplexed about, you know, the science of the brain. And, you know, you're talking about the ability to have this so-called brain outside of the body, and maybe that can't explain it, because not a lot of scientists have said that or will go there. You know, I guess the other half, the other side, simply puts a spiritual twist to it mm-hmm. and ties it in that way. But, you know, we're all energy. And it's very possible that whatever is happening truly has a physics behind it. We just don't really understand it.
Mm-hmm. And I'm no physicist. But I will tell you that I believe that the near-death experience is actually the experience of death, the experience of the death process, interrupted by resuscitation. Now, if we have the capacity or if we're forced to die in a certain way, if dying and having these experiences is a human behavior, which I realize stretches the word behavior a little bit, but if it's a human behavior, and if we all have it, then, and all human behaviors, all universal human behaviors, are the result of our evolutionary history, then the death process is an evolutionary adaptation that contributed to the survival of our species at some point in our evolutionary history.
I'm going to ask you something you might not be able to answer, but if you
wouldn't be the first.
But if you can, you'll probably give us the best answer we've ever had.
Well, I hope so.
If from the moment someone physically dies, where the body stops to function, I'll put it that way, could you kind of give us your best feelings on what you think happens then?
What they experience subjectively?
Yes.
It depends on who they are, what culture they are, what culture they're from. There are even differences that have been noted in the near-death experiences reported by those who die suddenly car crashes and so forth, and those who are able to anticipate their death, like cardiac patients who have only a little while to live and their doctors tell them this. But in general, there seems to be a pattern. It's been published and put out where people can see it. It's called the Ring Scale, and those who want to learn a little more about it should look into the work of Kenneth Ring, for whom it is named. And a typical first phase of the near-death experience is an out-of-body experience. That's what most people in the field agree on. I include the emotions that were happening just before the person died as a part of that process, but we may or may not return to that. The first is an out-of-body experience. The second is the experience of going through a tunnel or being in the void. And the descriptions of the void match my experience of the void that I had during childhood epileptic seizures. Sometimes those voids even have the point of light in the middle of it. And then the person goes through the tunnel and gets into the light, or they see that point of light and move towards it and enter it. Then the next thing that's commonly reported is meeting what's called dead friends and relatives, but it's not always dead friends and relatives. I know a woman who had a near-death experience and saw Jim Morrison. I've counted no fewer than 3 near-death experiences that include references to Elvis Presley.
So Morrison is dead then?
Well, evidently so. And I'm sorry to say this, but so is Elvis.
That's true.
So what I think is happening there is that people are encountering, they're having the experience of meeting with other people who they know are dead. And what this conveys to the person is, you are dead. This is the other world. This mm-hmm. is the, if you want to use the term, this is the afterlife. And then when they're there, they know they're dead, but it's a joyful reunion. This is your old girlfriend whom you saw in college and who died tragically in a car crash.
Yeah.
And you never really got over her. And there she is. And you can look into her eyes and she smiles and she loves you and something feels complete. And then you might say to yourself, hey, this being dead stuff isn't all that bad.
Is it that way until the end of time for you? I mean, does it just go on endlessly, or is there some kind of end to all of this?
Well, there are a couple of other phases, but apparently there is an end. There is an end to a near-death experience. Whether there's an end to life or whether there's an end to consciousness after the body stops functioning is another question. But after you meet with dead friends and relatives, you then find yourself, and now you're bathed and covered in this light, and everything that you perceive is made of this light. And then a single being will emerge, either causing the rest or at the same time as the rest sort of withdraw, or he just appears. And near-death experience researchers have called this the being of light, and most people who experience it without hesitation call it God. Many call it an angel, but we're definitely dealing with a being whose presence is made of light and fills you with a sense of love and being accepted. And I believe that prepares you, that sense of being totally accepted, absolutely as you are, for the next phase, which I believe is the most crucial one in the near-death experience, in the death process, and the reason for its whole existence, and that's the life review. And during the life review, you might re-experience your entire life in an eye blink. And some of them say that it leaves absolutely nothing out. It's your entire life, all 3 score year and 10 in a matter of seconds. Some
the watch, good, the bad, everything.
Everything. Some watch their life pass before their eyes, an experience that can also occur before the death process begins, as you're about to crash into the concrete abutment, as you're falling off the mountain, and your life will flash before your eyes, which is one of the reasons I think it's so crucial, but if we look at it closer, I can give you far better reasons. I know of 2 cases where people were in rooms where a huge wall was covered with television screens, and each screen was replaying an incident or an episode from the person's life. Then once that's over, once you've reviewed your life, there's another phase that sometimes happens, but usually doesn't. And researchers have given it the name transcendent experience. And I think that's really a case of for want of a better word. But what happens there is that mysteries are revealed. And my best guess is that if you go through your life, through the life review, and you then get to the end of that and you want more, you want to know what the cosmos is about, you want to know how human history and how life unfolds. If you want to know something about your larger destiny beyond what you experienced in that one life, then these mysteries will be revealed to you one way or another.
If you want to.
If you want them. There was one guy, Mellon Thomas Benedict, who's a regular speaker at near-death, the International Association for Near-Death Studies conferences. And for him, when he was in this phase, shapes would appear in front of him. And something about the shape and its presence would convey some information to them. Others end up in what's called the Akashic Record. So they'll literally experience themselves in a huge, enormous library, and they only have to think of something they want to know about. And a book that will have that information will manifest in front of them, answering their questions.
So they may say, I want to see the universe, how it created itself, or how it was created.
And
you'll get that answer?
They will get an answer. Whether or not it's the answer depends on, well, many factors, lots of things that I wouldn't be able to address. And another form that this can take, and it personally, when my death comes to claim me, I certainly hope to have this experience. There's a council of 12 people, and these beings, the Council of 12, as they've been nicknamed, can actually help the person plan their next incarnation. Of course, this experience is limited to those who believe in reincarnation.
But what if, Todd,
as I do,
what if you're wrong? What if my belief system is wrong and there's nothing? You die and it's over. It's done.
Ah, then I should hang up the phone because we're wasting our time. But I'm not going to do that.
No, you aren't.
What if it all comes
to nothing? Because I'll call you back.
Yes, thank you. Well, now, why wouldn't it all come to nothing? And I'm going to go back to that because I'm at the very last phase here.
All right.
And that is the point of no return. And something will happen. A person will encounter an obstacle. I remember once it was a door at the end of a short hallway. Another, it can be a kind of grayish cloud. And somehow the person knows that if they proceed any further, their chances for coming back to life or for resuscitation will disappear. And from that point on, that's the end of it. And then it's over. And it's called the point of no return. And I don't know of a single near-death experience where anyone got past it and then was resuscitated to tell the tale. Now, why wouldn't it all come to nothing? And the answer is that I believe that the death process, as made explicit, as explicated through the near-death experience, is the result of our evolutionary history. And I'm a believer in reincarnation. You can ask me about that in a couple of minutes. But what I think is happening with the life review, where huge numbers of behaviors are re-experienced, or somehow we are exposed to our own behaviors in this state of total acceptance so that we can look at our negative stuff because we're in the presence of God who loves us absolutely, unquestioningly, no matter what has happened, is that states of consciousness that inspire behaviors or the behaviors themselves are tagged for repetition or avoidance in the next life. And what this does, assuming you can accept that there is such a thing as reincarnation, we can look at that some more. What that does is it predisposes us in our next life to have a higher level of social skills than we had in our past life. So that each life we get a little bit more able to behave well with other people.
In the mere fact that someone like you, our audience, someone like me even questioning you, are talking about this, does that mean we may have evolved at a higher point at this point?
No, I think that rather it's simply a reflection of modern medical technique. We are able to resuscitate more and more patients. For example, when someone drowned 60, 80 years ago, as soon as they stopped breathing, we took for granted that they were drowned. Then somebody invented mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and we realized, well, drowning isn't the end. We can bring them back. And I know of cases where people have been dead from drowning for up to 3 hours and been resuscitated from it. But we didn't know that not very long ago. So more and more people are coming back to life because we have more and more ways to try and bring them back to life. But if you don't mind, I'd like to return
Please,
to the point about the life review.
Okay.
So we tag behaviors for repetition or avoidance in the next life. Then, if you can accept my premise, we reincarnate. Now we're born already knowing, already having a set of social skills. So what happens if you have better social skills than the next guy? You've got a better chance of becoming an alpha or beta, male or female. Now, in every primate species, without exception, including ours, the higher you get along the social ladder, the more mating opportunities you have. For men, if you're a female, being an alpha female means that you have a kind of prestige. People want to sort of curry favor with you, mm-hmm. and they will bring you little gifts and do things for you. Now, 100,000 years ago, maybe 200,000 years ago, when we emerged as a species, that little extra gift for the alpha female meant more food, more protein, more carbohydrates for her offspring, so that having past life learning increased your chances for passing on your DNA to another generation and seeing that generation reach adulthood. Reincarnators bred out non-reincarnators, at least that's my opinion, for the evolutionary basis for it. Reincarnation, the death process, as it manifests in the near-death experience, is an evolutionary adaptation that pre-adapts people to live in complex culture, like what we all live in. Whether you're busy trading pigs and sweet potatoes for social position mm-hmm. in Papua New Guinea, or you're the chief executive officer of a major corporation, you need social skills to get to the top. And if you've got them, you got a better chance than the next guy. So it actually allows us to solidify, and increase our reliance on culture as our evolutionary strategy.
Do people ever go backwards instead of forwards in the reincarnation process?
The theory, hypothesis, that I'm working with doesn't have room for that. But I suppose it's possible. In principle, a person could sustain brain damage while they're still alive that would disturb their capacity for memory, and along with that, their capacity to review their life.
I mean, I look at, for example, Todd, and we're rapidly approaching the top of the hour here, but someone like a Jeffrey Dahmer, I mean, my God, what was he like in his previous life?
I don't know. I do know, however, that most of the really modern adaptations to our bodies and our minds tend to be a little bit problematic. We stand upright, but we're prone to lower back pain.
Mm-hmm.
We have a long pregnancy followed by a long childhood, the idea being to get the fetus to grow as much as it possibly can and still be able to get out of the body. And yet, we have tremendous problems with childbirth. Before modern medicine got involved, we had a lot of women dying in childbirth. Our brains are also a recent evolutionary adaptation, as they are now, and we have problems with the newer parts of the brain, so we get psychiatric disorders.
Let's talk more about reincarnation when we come back with you, Todd. I'm George Norrie. We'll be back in a moment. Fascinating. This is Coast to Coast AM.